Good evening, everyone. Thank you for joining us for this chat to some teachers who were at Wellington College in the Common Room during the 1980s. So I'm going to introduce our panel this evening. We have Mike Borden, who taught maths at Wellington from 1972 to 1994. We have Howard Tomlinson,
Hi.
who taught history from 1977 to 87. We have Julia Benamar.
Hi.
Hello. Julia taught modern languages from 1982 to 92. And we have Mark Slater, who also taught modern languages. Hi, Mark.
Hello.
Hi, and he was at Wellington from 1982 to 1996. So to begin with, I'm going to ask you a general question about the 1980s and how you might describe the spirit or the atmosphere of the 1980s as it was manifested at Wellington. Howard, I think you have some thoughts on this.
Thanks, Carol. I'm going to start by thanking you and Chris and Lucy for the invitation. I've spent the last few days thinking a little bit about the 1980s, and it brought back many happy memories. So I'm grateful for the opportunity to be here. I'm going to answer this in a sort of political way because I think the zeitgeist of spirit really was a Thatcherite spirit of the age, and she was the leading spirit. Whatever you think about her, you were attracted or repelled, really. And I would say that Wellington was pretty Thatcherite. And I've got just not the Common Room. I think the Common Room was much more liberal and with a small L. And I was regarded as incredibly wet, I think, or wetter than I was. But I was thought politically as something of a radical, maybe, but not as radical as someone like Noel Worswick. But there were exceptions, of course, but generally the student body, I would say, was pretty conservative. That track conservative. Just a couple of illustrations about that. In terms of the Falklands War, and I had a number as an undershoot at Hopetoun, boys whose fathers were involved, so that's not unexpected. And secondly, I can't remember any of the very few mass protests, and it was, I would suggest, conservative with a small c. I mean, I can remember two issues, a big food fight in the dining hall, sort of mass protest, and I can remember a banner on chapel at the end of term saying George Davis is innocent. He was a sort of minor criminal at the time, but I think it was pretty conformist, student body as a whole, and hardworking, I would say. And probably this compared hugely with the school 10, 15 years earlier, in the late 60s, I guess. So that's my sort of political take on it.
Can I come in,
Sure.
Caroline? I think Howard's absolutely got that absolutely spot on. I think it was Thatcher's Britain, wasn't it, the 80s? And it's generally seen as an age of personal ambition and hard work and self-advancement. And I think young people in the 60s and 70s seemed to want to reject the values of their previous generations and seemed to want to change the world. And in the 80s, young people seemed to want to espouse their parents' values. It seemed to want to lay down a foundation for a very successful life and to make a lot of money and to be prosperous. And so I think there was a real sort of watershed at the beginning of the 80s. And how did that manifest itself at Wellington?
Does that make it easier to be a teacher if they all want to go to
Yes, in a
university
way,
and
I think so. There was less of the rebel. I mean, the film If, Lindsay Anderson's iconic film, was very much a part of our culture in the 70s at school, and that was a film about the overthrow of a public school by the students. I don't think there was that sort of culture in the 80s. I think Wellingtonians did work harder. They were intent on building an impressive CV for the future in the form of their personal statement and reference for what was then called an UCA form, later became a UCAS form. And as a housemaster, I think, you know, we would get well used to trying to persuade the more recalcitrant ones who wanted to sort of sit on their backside and not do very much. We would always have recourse to the line, "It'll look good on your rucker form." And that generally seemed to work. So they were ambitious.
Yes. No, you'd actually left Wellington, you were there as a student and left in 1972. And then you came back 10 years later.
Yeah. So yeah, I had 10 years away.
What kind of struck you when you came back? What had changed?
What had changed? Well, I mean, the most obvious thing is co-education. Because when I was there, in fact, there was one female student in my final 2 years, and that was actually Chris Potter's sister, who studied modern languages with me. But she must have had a terribly lonely time because none of us dared talk to her. And it was very much a boys' school. By 1982, when I came back, it was still very much a boys' school, but there were 50 or 60 girls.
Sure.
And so it was taking faltering steps down the road towards co-education, but I wouldn't say it was a properly co-educational school.
No. And someone in our last panel described it as cosmetic co-education. So we'll be touching on that a bit later.
Yeah.
Julia, would you like to say anything in general about the 80s?
I really didn't become aware of the environment to a huge degree until almost the mid-80s, because I arrived in 82 and began teaching part-time. And it was 3 or 4 years later that I actually became full-time. So I had a sort of shoehorn into it. I thought it was a place where children were encouraged to push themselves. And if they didn't, then we would jolly well encourage them to. For all the reasons Mark said, they were incredibly keen to show the powers that be, particularly on things like UCA forms, which, of course, given that we only had girls in the sixth form, we were they became incredibly important. And they would do virtually anything that you suggested would look good for university application or any other application they chose to make at the end of for the end of their upper sixth year. I thought it was a school that catered incredibly well for the boys. Academically, it dealt very well with the girls. The girls got a very good deal out of it. But outside of the classroom, it was, because of their reduced numbers, it was much more restricted. Actually, I think, was... as you just described it, it was a bit of an add-on, and it had been put together without in-depth thought about what the girls might contribute in a positive sense and how the school might help them to become young adults who were well-rounded. It was still very much a boys' school with the girls added on.
I see some of our audience have already twigged that they can contribute with the Q&A and the chat. And do feel free to do that during our conversation. And towards the end, we'll be having a look through some of the questions that you've sent in and be putting those to the panel. Now, David Newsome was the head throughout the 1980s. So in the way he set the tone of the 1980s at Wellington. Now, Mike, you had already spent 8 years under the previous head, Frank Fisher. Can you tell us how Newsome compared or contrasted to Frank Fisher?
Certainly. Fisher was really the doyen of headmasters in the country at that stage. And he's chairman of the HMC. He's a very good appointer. Must have been, he appointed me. But he appointed a lot of very good staff in the time that he was there, many of whom went off to be heads of other schools. When David Newsome arrived, I think he came with the intention of trying to improve the academic standard of the school. I'm not sure how effective this was. Wellington, I thought, was a magnificent school, is a magnificent school. And at that stage, it catered very well for a wide variety of intellects. And I think one of the problems with modern day league tables is they tend to measure the intake more than what actually happens at the school. And I think we had a widespread, I mean, I ran the line doc, and in there, there was a widespread of abilities. I mean, I think we coped very well with the really bright people, but the people who are just going to get through 5 years at the school and hopefully come out with a couple of A-levels, not very good ones, we did very well to do that. I always remember at the end of term, at the end of a schoolboy's career, I would write to the prep school headmaster and say that I gave him a rundown on how his pupil had done at the school. And I remember writing slightly apologetically about one boy who had got a couple of mediocre A-levels, but had qualified to go to Sandhurst. The letter I got back, he was writing of congratulations. He said, I'd never thought he'd get an O-level, let alone an A-level. And I think that was, we had a widespread and we did very well by them. At that time, and we continued to do that, under David Newsom, but I'm not sure the standard overall improved very much during that time.
Could I? What would you say? Yeah, could I comment on that? Because I think I came from an academic background. I knew David Newsom well, and he was in my department, so I can only speak. Really, before league tables coming in 92 nationally, there's no real academic comparison or easily obtained. But I would say that in our area, in history politics, certainly the academic standard improved considerably at the top end, certainly in terms of Oxford and Cambridge entry.
And so, how did you bring that about?
Lots of ways, really. Clearly, high expectations of said department. Making some good appointments with David Newsom, doing a lot of history outside the classroom, sort of establishing a history club with Michael Howard as president, not that he did anything. So we got some university dons and talked to the kids quite often. Lots of seminars and university type tutorials at the top end. Occasional lectures and that sort of thing. So certainly in my area, David Newsom was very helpful. Also establishing I think other departments are very cross really, a invigilated prize, which was normally invigilated by a Don, a senior history prize. So in all those sorts of ways, I think okay. Things helped.
Julia, Mark, were the standards going up in modern languages?
I think so. I think the academic standards generally were going up, but I always felt that one of the great strengths of Wellington was that it was much more than a school that focused on exam results and focused on the academic side. And you could be respected as a Wellingtonian without necessarily shining academically. And you could be respected for all sorts of other contributions that you made to the school. And I think that was an ethos which was very healthy. We were ambitious, the school was ambitious academically, but it respected people for all sorts of other things as well. And I'm quite certain that as people went on from school through university and into their careers, that will have laid a very good foundation for them in terms of the sort of all round people that they became.
Can I ask each of you in turn to think about a teaching colleague who you found particularly inspirational or helpful or you know, someone that you admired? Julia, would there be anyone in your...
I certainly found that the department as a whole was incredibly supportive, mm-hmm. and there was never any hesitation about exchanging worksheets or information about certain pupils who might need a hand or to be stretched. Norman Porter was incredibly good at bringing out the best in the staff, I think. And I agree with Mark that academic results did improve. But one of the things that struck me most positively about Wellington in my time there was how much respect there was, not just for the very bright girls that we always had in Apsley, because obviously they came in via some sort of, it was a competition really. It was very difficult to choose between them sometimes. But whatever talents they had, whatever talents any of the pupils had, were valued or became valued. The Arts Committee, I understand, was set up in the 80s, which I think was a very positive move. And I think as a result of that, those who were less likely to make the first 15 found other areas in which they could shine. And as Mark said, gain everyone's respect, quite rightly.
Mike, certainly, were there any teachers that you particularly looked up to?
So I particularly enjoyed being a member of the maths department, which I thought I was very lucky, appointed by Donald Parks and then Joe Tierney during the 70s, and then Brian Midgley came over. And it was a very happy department, as sure Chris will remember. I mean, we had some very good mathematicians, and we had some good mathematicians on the staff, and we produced very good results. But it was always it was great fun. There was a bit of hilarity in it, but I think we contributed outside the classroom as well as a department, and I think the pupils always appreciated that the person who was teaching them maths was also running around on the rugby field or the hockey field or something like that, and it made, I think, our relationship with the pupils a very good one, but certainly it was good standard, and there were some very bright people I was privileged to teach during those years.
How about you, Howard?
Sorry, could I just in again, Caroline, and say that one of the things that I hadn't come across before in sixth form particularly was team teaching. And because Mark and I were the only Hispanists at the time, team teaching with him was a whole new world to me, and clearly wasn't to him. So I much valued his input on all of that. Team teaching in our department worked incredibly well. As I say, it's something I've never come across before. Incredibly positive.
Does that mean you actually taught the class at the same time?
Or we did sort of... teach the class at the same time. They had 8 periods a week, for example, in Spanish. Mark would do 4 and I would do 4.
Okay, yeah.
But we were very closely, we talked a lot about who was doing what, and I found that incredibly helpful. So team teaching with Mark was an absolute godsend to me.
I'm glad I pulled the wool over your eyes, Julia. You were the one who knew all about it.
Could I just mention a couple of my department? Mark Labbert, I thought, was an excellent teacher, and a huge, especially British political history, American history. Richard Smythe, later on, was a very good appointment. I have huge respect for Peter White as a historian. He's very good with the...
And he was working senior. For a long time, yeah. Wasn't he?
Yeah, so that's just 3. There are others.
Thank you. In the Wellingtonian, David Newsome was interviewed around the end of his first year, and he mentioned that he'd felt very let down by the behaviour of the school at callover on his first speech day. Now, Mike and Howard, I know you were the teachers who would have been there at his first speech day. Can you remember anything that happened?
I can't remember anything unusual on that day.
I can't either. I asked Peter Waghorn the other day, and he couldn't remember, so it didn't make a huge impact on, on us.
Maybe one of our audience will be able to remember. At the end of his time, he gave another interview to the Wellingtonian, and one thing he said was that Wellington had been a hard school in many ways, and he'd tried to soften it. Do you understand what he meant by that, and did he succeed?
I think it was a. He described it as a tough school in his closing address when he left the school, and I think it was a tough school. Did he soften it? In some ways he did, in some ways he didn't. I think Wellingtonians under David Newsome were really nice people who were very loyal to their friends. There was huge loyalty in the school. And there was a great set of values, I thought, among Wellingtonians. There was less physical bullying than there had been certainly in the 70s. And certainly in the 60s when I was there. There was probably a gentler ethos than there had been, but I think it was still a tough school. I think he was right when he left to say that Wellington was a tough school. I suspect it remains so, probably until it became truly co-educational.
My wife Heather tells a story about teaching, I think, an upper sixth class when there were two girls and 10 boys in school, and she was very cross with them about the way the boys treated these two girls. And she went to see Newsome straight away. Newsome opened the door immediately, no problems about seeing him, and said, Heather made the observation, complaint, and he said, it is a very tough school, but it seems to be something in the brickwork. Just keep on with them and set your own high standard. So I think it could be difficult for girls who are just in a boys' set, just one or two of them. The other thing I would say that I think whereas drama had under Hugh Atkins had really been established in the 70s. I think in a way David Newsome puts music on the map more than it was
Someone in the comments mentioned Jared Armstrong and that he made a.
Jared Armstrong, and then Keith Pusey, I think, brought it on further. And people like Chris Brain, who's a brilliant organist and musician, you know, joined the CCF, and it became somehow more acceptable, I think, to play music, perhaps. Okay. Hilton Ancroft, the big band, I think was a success. So I think there are more people, you know, playing instruments and singing, and that had a sort of civilising effect. But it's still, I agree with Mark, pretty tough school, probably, even back when I left.
All four of you were involved as housemasters or dormitory tutors or under tutors to a greater or lesser extent. So I wonder if you could tell us a bit about what were the issues and challenges that you had to deal with as a housemaster in the 1980s.
Going back to what Howard just said about how difficult, and it must have been difficult to be just two girls in a group with 10 boys, the girls did have a couple of softer, in inverted commas, looking at how David Newsome softened the school, options available to them. They had a matron attached to the house who actually lived in, which none of the boys' houses did have, and she was pivotal in maintaining their emotional equilibrium a lot of the time. She was outstanding. They called her Matey, and they thought she was absolutely wonderful, which she was. She was the most enormous help to us when we were running the house. And I think also, because girls are so very different in many ways to boys, and I'm afraid they are. They had their own, they developed their own support system for situations that would arise in the classroom, and they were very good with each other, understanding of each other, and I think they shared much more amongst themselves what they were going through and gave each other tips as to how they might collectively deal with these situations. And I think perhaps that some of that ability to deal with challenges maybe got passed on to the boys, who became a little bit more open about their feelings, and things like PHSE being set up may have assisted in that. I don't know, but that's my take on the girls from what Howard's just said.
I'd say my biggest challenge as a housemaster was the weekend. The week was structured and much more controlled. The weekend was a nightmare, and Saturday nights I think were really quite challenging for housemasters and tutors. And then Sundays, how to keep people happy, not necessarily occupied, but to avoid boredom, because in those days far more people stayed in for the whole weekend. I think the
majority of
exodus,
people would.
Yeah, and the big exodus on Sunday didn't really start until probably the 90s or even the noughties. And I think in the 80s, if you ran a boarding house, you ran a boarding house for 7 days, and the Saturday and Sunday was quite challenging, particularly Saturday night.
Saturday nights, I remember there was always a queue on outside chapel on Sunday morning of various housemasters needing to talk to the master because of something that had happened the night before.
And a particularly big queue if it was your house dance the night before.
But you were aware of it. You were around on the Saturday night. You didn't just leave them to it.
No.
Which I think 10 years earlier, probably that they did.
What happened on Saturday? The senior boys had the JCR, but there were usually the junior boys hadn't got that, but they were still quite keen on getting, having a drink. And that was something we did find difficult. We just assumed, I think, as a staff, that we could look after the senior boys, but it was often the problems were at the junior level.
And I have got the impression that alcohol was quite an issue. So where were the junior boys getting that from?
Well, I suppose they brought it. I can remember, this was one thing that early on David Newsom was very keen on stamping down on. And he, at one stage, he had a sort of so-called amnesty and basically called, I think it was just the first 3 years in, I don't think it was the sixth form, I think it was the first 3 years, and he called the whole lot into an assembly and talked about the problems that the school was having and people having something to drink. And he basically said, I'd like you, anyone who has partaken of a drink this term, I would like them to go and report to the housemaster and admit what you've done. And I remember on a Saturday night at school, having heard from a couple of colleagues, they were rather annoyed at the number of people who'd been to see them, admitting that they had something to drink. And no one had come to me in the line dock, and I was feeling pretty proud about this. And then suddenly there was a knock at the door, and a small boy came in and admitted that he'd had some drink it was probably about a fortnight ago, but he said, just a sip. So I said, all right, we'll go. and thinking, well, at least someone's come forward. And then looked outside the door, and there was a queue of people all coming to tell me. And it was, they all said exactly the same thing. I didn't really have anything to do. I just had a sip. Someone else had got a bottle, and I just had a sip. Anyway, the whole crowd ended up going to see the master on Monday morning from all over the school. So, but it was a problem. I remember going away, away dances. I remember the odd occasion where boys would pluck up a bit of Dutch courage by taking a drink with them on the bus. And when they got there, they did not behave very well.
I know it was an era when it was much easier for teenagers to get served in pubs than it is now.
Could I just talk about a holding house? I was a junior house master tutor in
Epcot,
the last tutor at Epcot, which was for the first year, third 13-year-olds. And that had peculiar difficulties, not least the prefects I was sent, particularly from the Hope Town and the Murray. The lineup were very good. I had some very good prefects in the lineup, but some were tutors were just hoping to get rid of their boys, bad boys for a year and foist them onto me. But so that was a sort of peculiar issue. But the other problem is just getting to know the boys at the end of the first year, and they moved on to the senior houses. So that was quite difficult. And the third thing I would say is that the house was tumbling down, really, and it was going to be sold after I'd left, and was sold in 150 flats. So, you know, windows occasionally falling out was a problem. But it's a great house for us in terms of the accommodation for the family. So, yeah, happy memories, but had its own peculiar problems.
Yeah, thank you.
The comment I would make is that there were... in those days, there were dormitories and houses. Now they're all called houses.
Yes.
And I ran a dormitory, the Beresford, for 6 years. And then I ran a house, the Stanley, for 5 years. And the Stanley was infinitely easier to run than the Beresford.
Why do you think that was?
Well, because if running a dormitory, you were in a building with four other dormitories in the same area. And if something went wrong, it was almost impossible to nail down what had happened or who was responsible. And it was more feral, I suppose, if that's the right word. But what they all had in common, dormitories and houses, is that they all had this fantastic loyalty to the house. That was what I loved about Wellington. The boys and I think the girls in Apsley had a huge loyalty to their house, and that was really, really heartening. So, and made up for all the tricky times in house dances and problems arising on Saturday nights.
Thank you, Julia. Was alcohol a problem in the Apsley as well?
I was about to say, because the girls were that much older, more concentrated, a lot of them couldn't understand why there was this sort of rite of passage that a lot of the boys felt they had to go through. They were 16 plus, and most of them had been introduced to alcohol in small or slightly bigger quantities by their parents by the time they joined us anyway. So I guess they'd got beyond the stage of it being something that they weren't allowed. They didn't seem to be quite as obsessed with it as some of the boys were, because they'd already been introduced to it in a family setting before they joined us. Some of them did come from boarding schools, and I guess girls just start sooner. That's not to say we didn't have problems. I did spend quite a few Saturday nights sitting on a bed with a bucket or a bowl on the floor with one of the girls in absolute tears and three others trying to commiserate with her. But it was usually a one-off. It wasn't rife in any sense. They had a very, that their priorities were different. And I think they were quite good at entertaining themselves on Saturdays. Saturdays were a challenge, but clearly from what other former colleagues have said, they weren't nearly as seemingly insurmountable or difficult in APSE as they were in other houses. And I hadn't actually thought about what you've just said, Mark, that it was more difficult to run a dormitory than it was a house. And I can see that now. It must have been an incredible, incredible challenge.
Julia, to continue talking to you for a little while, when you joined the common room, there were one or two other female teachers? Two or three?
There was, yes, Pauline Williams was well established in the maths department. And I think a lady called Ros Jones, who was married to Nick Jones. I can't remember what Nick taught, but I think Ros taught
biology.
Biology. Thank you, Nick, Mark. So there were not very many ladies in the common room at all. And
did it feel a bit awkward?
I didn't feel awkward. I mean, you need to ask the gentlemen on this panel how they felt about it. I think the general feeling, I've thought about this in the week since we last spoke, and I think the general feeling must have been that this move towards the odd female teacher here is only temporary, and it's just a blip, and we'll go back to the male common room as soon as we possibly can. I don't think anybody really saw it as a thin end of anybody's wedge or anything. And I didn't give it a great deal of thought at the time. I went in, did what I needed to do, did a job that I absolutely loved, and then went home and had two children at home to look after, etc. So my time was very carefully boxed up, as it were. I think one or two people in the common room, particularly those who'd been there quite a long time, found it more challenging than, shall I say, the younger members of staff. And
particularly perhaps if they were bachelors and that was their social circle. And
particularly if they were bachelors, yes, the one I'm thinking about. My biggest challenge in common room was at the time eliciting a good morning from one very long-standing member of common room who took at least 6 months to return my good morning from him. I didn't give up, but he was, I think it, him feel uncomfortable.
What are you talking about?
Don't be too worried about that. I think when I first arrived at Wellington, there were a few people who didn't talk to me for a long time. One of the things that, of course, most of the early on, I think the female members of Common Room were married, sometimes married to one of the members of Common Room. But, I mean, someone like Pauline Williams, I mean, she was married but lived outside. And they didn't really interrupt what was going on in Common Room until the late 80s, when suddenly Newsom appointed Tiggy to the staff, and she was then I think the first sort of an honorary bachelor, and she lived in and she dined in Common Room and that sort of thing, and that was quite quite hard for her. And it was, I always remember that she told the story of, I think, the first breakfast she came into, and at breakfast there were various rules. You all sat in the same place and you didn't talk and you read your newspapers. But she came in, wasn't quite sure, and wanted to sit next to someone and picked up some knife and fork and went over and sat and was waiting and was on another table when the bishop, Richard Coleman, came into the common room and suddenly noticed that his knife and fork had disappeared, and he exploded and said, where's my knife and fork? Who's been messing around with things? And of course, Tiggy was very upset and sort of had to sort of hand back the knife and fork and didn't quite know what to do. But apparently in the evening there was a very good bottle of wine in her pigeonhole and an apology from Richard Coleman about his behaviour in the morning. But so I think you were probably protected from that, Julia.
Yes, indeed. I did actually wonder at one point whether a female presence in common room at any time of the day or evening was seen by some to indicate that their behaviour would need to change because of the presence of the fairer sex, and that was going to mean a difference in the way they acted, and that was a sort of something they didn't want to contemplate. I may be imagining that.
Julia, you had two children while you were at Wellington.
What? I did. I had one at the end of 1982. No, I had Alice early in 83 and I had Emily late in 84.
Well, what did you have to do for childcare?
I had to be super organised. I have visions of my then husband and I exchanging various bundles in the car during the 5 minute break between lessons. Mm-hmm. So time organisation was essential. I later relied, as more and more ladies became members of Common Room, Rain Walker and Christine MacArthur, we had children of the same age. So we shared the childcare, and I think it was Noel Worswick did the timetable at the time. So he always seemed to manage to work it that one of us would be free at any given time of the day. So we'd spend a lot of time running up and down Chapel Hill to and from the Orange House. Between us, we based ourselves at the Orange House, and the children were looked after in little groups there, which was absolutely wonderful for them. They thought it was great. And I didn't sleep a great deal. Marking had to be done sometime. But yeah, childcare, there was no official childcare, but the kindness of other people and cooperation between newly appointed lady members of staff were key to our being able to do it as well as we did.
Could I just say that Wellington seems to me, looking back, a great place for families, young families. And one of the great things that Frank Fisher did, which continued throughout the 80s, was to have lunch for families at 12 o'clock before the boys came in. Okay. Which must have been a help for everybody, really.
It was indeed, Howard. It was one of the ways, again, that struck me when I first arrived at Wellington and after I'd had my first baby, that Wellington did a huge amount to make all the wives, because you didn't have to have had children to go to wives' lunch if you were simply a wife of a member of Common Room, that, if you weren't working outside the college, obviously you were on site. It was a way of Wellington making us feel part of the whole community. And that was, it was much valued by all the wives.
I think that there was an incredible camaraderie generally in Wellington Common Room, and I dare say that still exists. And I think I had the impression when I went to other schools that they knew that we had something special at Wellington. There was a sort of a feeling on the network, on the grapevine, that that Wellington had a really special atmosphere in the Common Room. Whether it was whether that was partly to do with the social club, whether it was to do with the way we were looked after in Common Room, we had the couple, the Thompsons, who looked after the bachelors in Common Room, and it was a great atmosphere. I think that mutual support and friendship probably found its way down into the pupil community, because the other reputation that I think Wellington had was that Wellingtonians stuck together when they left. And that was something that I often heard coming not just from Wellingtonians, but from people at university who had met Wellingtonians and had got a sense that this school has a certain sort of camaraderie and an emphasis on friendship, which not every school has.
I'm going to move you on now.
I was going to mention the Tuesday evening dinners, which were a highlight of the week, very often.
Yeah. And the progressive party—they were great. They were great fun.
Still goes on.
I would just also mention, the camaraderie, because I was a bachelor housemaster when I was at Wellington, and there were a lot of the tutors at that stage were bachelors, but we were able to get together, and particularly in the West Block with Frank Richards in the Murray and Chris in the Hill. And, if you'd got a problem, you could wander along, to someone else's flat and just sit down and talk over the problem. And there's, as I said, great friendships there as well. And we all had actually a really good time. I very much enjoyed my time at Wellington.
Time is getting on quite a bit, but I did want to briefly touch on sport, which has always been a big Wellington enthusiasm. And I wonder whether you think the 1980s were a golden age for sport at Wellington?
Mark, go on. Are you going
to start,
Mark? Or?
Oh, no, go on. I'll bow to you. I was number two to you in the hockey.
Okay. I thought the standard of sport at Wellington throughout my time there was always very good. Obviously, it was very well known for its rugby, and we did, a good year was when it was an unbeaten season, and a not so good year was you probably only lost one or two matches. Mm. And it was also true in the other sports, the hockey, the cricket. The lovely thing at that stage was that we were the first 11 or the first 15 was made up of people who'd been there for 5 years. And I think that we hadn't got into the stage of sports scholarships and that sort of thing. And the standard was extremely good. I was lucky in the hockey world because it was the time when Astros were just coming in and we built our Astro, I think in about 86 or 87. And one of the first schools to do it. And
is this the one that now bears your name?
Well, yes, that slightly embarrassed, yeah. But I was very lucky running it with John Martin, who was a very good tactician. He read a game very well, and we ran it together. We had some very good players, Bill Waugh, who went to Sydney Olympics. The cricket was always very strong as well. And the lovely thing was that people tended to do all three sports rather than having to specialise as people are nowadays.
I would say that the sport was very good and possibly not a golden age, I don't know, but it was very high standard. But where I thought Wellington excelled was in giving vast numbers of boys and girls the opportunity to represent the school and to play in a team. And it didn't matter that it wasn't necessarily the first 15, the first 11, could have been playing, for a seventh 15. And that I thought was terrific and gave people a lot of self-respect and they were recognised even people in the first 15 would take an interest in how many of the lesser teams, how well the lesser teams had done that day. And I thought that was a fantastic plus. I thought that was a fantastic strength of the school.
We're getting a lot of comments here about how great it was to be in the fifth, the sixth, the seventh, 15. So, yeah.
Especially against beating Radley, I think, when we turned up 25 sides or whatever it was. And the other thing I would say is I did a bit of cricket coaching, but great fun, occasional matches, occasional cricket occasional on Sunday. It's part boys, part.
And also common room matches.
Yeah, and common room.
Played against Charterhouse and Eton. Yeah. They were always good fun.
It was a little bit
harder for the girls.
It was a little different for the girls because it was very difficult for them. If you can imagine that on a sports afternoon, every single pitch in the college was used before girls ever appeared. So it was quite difficult for them to carve out practice times and match times because we had to wait until the boys had finished. And they secondly, if they fielded a lacrosse team and there was a lacrosse match or even just a practice, even some training, the lacrosse, the pitches where they played lacrosse were so hacked to pieces that we became very unpopular with the ground staff. So that was another challenge. The other challenge that faced them was, for example, fielding a complete hockey team and a complete lacrosse team, not to mention an additional couple of netball teams at the weekend or midweek, was actually enormously difficult because the same girls were sporty, end of. What impressed me most was that girls who had played hockey learned to play lacrosse, and the lacrosse players learned to play hockey so that the teams could be not quite interchangeable, but at least they took such pride in fielding their sports teams as an APSLE team that they were prepared to play a game that they had never played before to represent the college.
We had an interesting question come in on the chat, which I'm going to put to you if I can find it. It was about whether corporal punishment was abolished in schools in the mid 80s, and did that make a difference, or had it already died a death at Wellington by then?
I'll come in. I think, yes, it did make a difference. It was a method of punishment which the boys, I think they preferred it to the alternatives, which were suspension or being sent home or something like that, and it was all over with. And when it was abolished, I remember saying to someone, if you do that again, you'll be in trouble. Well, in the old days, they knew what that meant. But now, when I said it, I didn't know what it meant, and they didn't know what it meant, and one had to think of various ways of, you know, giving them your own personal detention, and in that usually involved you in trouble and or, you know, them getting up early in the morning. But so it probably died at 80, I don't know, mid-80s, I think.
It died in 1985.
86, it was abolished in state schools.
The year I became a housemaster, and I was hugely relieved because I thought I was going to have to beat boys, and luckily it was abolished that term. And so my only experience of corporal punishment was as a boy, as a victim.
I'm going to ask all four of you the same question now, because all four of you went straight from Wellington to become head teachers at other schools, which is quite an achievement. So when you think about that in retrospect, did Wellington give you good skills that you took forward to being a head teacher elsewhere? And can you tell us a bit about that?
I thought being a head of department was valuable in terms of appointments and management, induction, and chairing meetings and so on. So that was useful. And clearly as a tutor, that was important in terms of pastoral and parental contact and so on. Yeah. What I missed, I think, was not having any experience really, apart from perhaps the odd curriculum committee of senior leadership teams or senior management. I think in some ways heads these days that have gone through the deputy headship route, and many have, are better trained or prepared than I was. And I remember in my last year going to an Industrial Society conference, just because I felt if I was applying for headships, I needed that sort of backup in terms of the theory, anyway, of being a head. So it's pluses and minuses, really. But actually having being head of the department and a tutor at the same time, that was valuable, certainly.
I thought that, particularly having been a housemaster, I think it was very important that if you're going into a boarding school such as Wellington, I think it's very important that a head should have been a housemaster at some stage, where his ability to obviously get to know a small number of boys very well, and particularly their parents, and dealing with those. So I think that being a housemaster was very good. I also found the leadership courses that Jonty Driver started down at Ross-on-Wye, I didn't think really were going to help me, particularly being a housemaster, but certainly they were certainly of great use when I went on to be a head.
Yes, I would back that up, Mike, because I attended one or two of the courses at Ross-on-Wye, and you're absolutely right that work on the pastoral side in Apsley was a fantastic part of what I took away from Wellington to my headships. And the ability to deal with the range of challenges that throws up, as well as dealing with parents, was invaluable. The one thing I had to go and ask, I think I went to the bursar at Wellington and asked him to teach me how to read a spreadsheet.
Yes, I think we're all on the same page here, because I felt that housemastering was very good preparation for dealing with pupils as a head, for dealing with parents, but not such good preparation for dealing with staff. Because as a housemaster, you really did very little management of staff. You had a team of under tutors, but it was pretty, you know, they would come in one evening a week or whatever it was. And you didn't really get any preparation for man management. But dealing with the pupils, the problems that arose from having 500 or whatever it was pupils under your care, and dealing with the reactions of their parents, that's something that housemastering prepared you for quite well.
We've had another question, which was, what's the funniest thing that you can remember happening in or about the Commons?
Can I answer that? I was, as I said, trying to improve history by taking kids out, really. And I borrowed the CCF Land Rover, because no other vehicle was available. And I took this group of six, I think Jonathan White and Sigurdsson people, and I was late. And we were going to the National Theatre to see a history play. And I went down the ramp, and the vehicle got stuck, because I didn't realise it was a great big overcarriage on it. And I smashed a water pipe and couldn't go forward or back. And I just abandoned the vehicle by the underground park. I let the others get back. And there are lots of army types in the Land Rover, and they took off the roof rack to get out. But that was, looking back, quite funny, but scary at the time.
Yeah. I think I can't remember a particular incident, but what I really enjoyed were the old common room plays that they used to put on at the end of the summer term, and there were some, and sometimes operas, but there were some very amusing moments in those.
It's always good for students to be able to see their teachers letting their hair down a bit in something.
She
like
Stoops
that.
To Conquer was absolutely priceless. Mm.
Okay. Well, we've reached 7:30. My colleague Lucy has been keeping an eye on the messages as well. Is there anything else, Lucy, that you think we should be?
There hasn't been any more questions. There was loads of comments that came in about the sports at Wellington that I'm sure you can all see, and quite a few comments on smuggling in alcohol when they were back at school, which was quite interesting. So thank you so much for everyone who's commented and written in. It's great to listen to you. And thank you so much to Howard, Mark, Mike and Julia, and of course to Caroline. It's been a brilliant evening.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
Been great.
Enjoyed it very much.
Yeah, very much. Lovely to see some names from the past as well coming up on the chat.
I've noticed who it was.
Yeah, hopefully we can pass all the comments and chat on to you so that you can have a reminisce over all of those.
That would be great.
Thanks very much.
Of course. Well, thank you so much, everyone, for tuning in. We hope you enjoyed it.